This is Audible.
Podium Audio presents Revenge at Raleigh High, Book 2 of Raleigh Rebels, written by Callie Hart, performed by Teddy Hamilton and Charlotte North. One. Silver. Samuel Adrian Hawthorne, devoted son, beloved friend, talented sportsman. A bright light taken too soon. Here we weep, but in heaven the angels rejoice, for one of their own has returned home to them. The midnight forest breathes deep around the cemetery, drawing the night into its lungs, its mournful limbs swaying on a cold breeze, as I look down upon the grave of Samuel Adrian Hawthorne. The frozen ground feels like it's pulsing beneath my feet, the beat of a somber drum rising through the non-existent soles of my chucks. But it's only my own blood, protesting the fact that I've been standing here too long. It'll be time to leave soon enough. But tonight, I've come here to face a demon, and I won't go until it's slain. Behind me, I hear the muffled shushing of waves lapping at the shore of Lake Cushman. Winter's arrived in full force. It won't be long before the lake begins to ice over. But for now, the water remains free to roll pebbles and rake the sands at the beach line. Mallory Hawthorne, Sam's mom, refused to have her son buried in the Raleigh Gardens of Rest Cemetery on the outskirts of town. No one needed to ask why, but Mallory went around Raleigh exclaiming loudly to anyone within earshot that she wouldn't have her poor murdered son fertilizing the same ground as the sick bastard who'd killed him. 3 times she's brought a petition before Mayor Griffith, demanding that Leon Wickman be exhumed and cremated, so no one will ever have to set eyes on his headstone again. 3 times Mayor Griffith has dismissed her, asking her to let the matter rest, but the chances of that happening are negligible. Mrs. Hawthorne keeps on doing her rounds through Raleigh, going door to door with her list of signatures and addresses, and each time she shows up at the town hall, her petition has gotten longer. It'll only be a matter of time. Some kind of night bird lets out an eerie, plaintive wail deep within the forest, and a cold sweat breaks out across the back of my neck. I don't want to be here. I don't enjoy hanging out in cemeteries in the middle of the night for the fun of it. I was drawn here, though, an undeniable force pulling on my insides, tugging me through the lateness of the night as I drove the Nova up the long, winding roads that lead toward the lake, the car's headlights guiding me toward Sam. Devoted son, beloved friend, talented sportsman. My eyes follow the sharp line and curve that form the letters of each engraved word, knowing without the faintest glimmer of doubt that Mallory Hawthorne believes these statements to be true. It's amazing how little parents really know about their children. They give birth to this creature who sucks them dry physically, financially, and emotionally. As the child grows, beginning to form, developing character traits and personality quirks that make it a unique cog in the machinations of society, it becomes very difficult for mothers and fathers to really see the teeth that form on that cog. Their rose-tinted view paints their children with all the beautiful gifts they wish to bestow on them: kindness, loyalty, honesty, intelligence. The blind love they feel for their child builds them up to be this blameless, perfect being, brimming with so much potential that their offspring might as well be the second coming of Christ. So, when they find out that their blameless, perfect child is really a monster, it's no great surprise that they won't accept the truth. Some cogs don't fit into the places assigned to them. They make the machine skip, their teeth too sharp and too grating. They are square pegs that won't fit in round holes. That doesn't mean that the determined and the persistent won't keep on trying to jam them into place, of course. Mallory Hawthorne will believe her son was a saint until the day she fucking dies. I suppose he was quite good at sports.
Sammy just got back from surfing in Hawaii. Do you think he's hot?
The memory rushes me like the cold water of the Cushman tide. I try not to let my mind catch on it, but the sights and sounds of that night are bright as comets when they flare across the landscape of my mind, and just as unstoppable. Sam, standing shirtless in front of the bathroom mirror,
face split with a grin as he stoops down to do a rail of coke. Jake standing behind him, grinding his hard dick up against my ass as he trades suggestive looks with his friends. Sam queuing up Sublime and cranking the music loud to mute my screams. Sam handing Jake the razor he uses to cut away my clothes. Sam leaning his body weight against me, holding me down as Jake paws at my naked body. Sam taking his turn, climbing on top of me, his breath reeking of whiskey, eyes unfocused, that terrible, mindless grin still twisting his features like some circus clown maw. And then, after all of that was over, Sam downstairs at the party. I blink rapidly, gouging my fingers into my palms, hoping that the pain will shock me out of the past, but it's too late. I recognize the song blasting through Mr. Wickham's state-of-the-art $30,000 speaker system, but I'm not really hearing it. It's impossible to hear much over the high-pitched ringing in my ears. My mouth still finds the shape of the lyrics as they pump out into the living room, though. My lips work of their own accord, silently repeating the chorus of the song like a prayer. I feel nothing. Even when I trip on the last step of the stairs, twisting my ankle as I lurch forward, barely catching my footing before going sprawling across the dove-gray marble floor in the foyer, I feel absolutely nothing. The house is packed to the rafters. There are faces here I don't recognize. Or maybe I do know them. Everyone looks unfamiliar as I stumble toward the front door, bile boiling in my stomach, choking me, clawing its way up the back of my throat.
Silver? Silver, Jesus, what the hell are you wearing? Is that one of Mr. Wickman's shirts?
There's a girl standing in front of me. Fine wisps of her beautiful red hair are stuck to her forehead, curled, captured in the sheen of her sweat. She's wearing a royal blue dress that makes her eyes look as bottomless as the sea. Her pupils are blown wide open. Halliday. Her name is Halliday. She's one of my best friends, and she's frowning at me like she's just realized something is very, very wrong.
Silver? Oh my God, Sil, is that blood?
Robotically, I look down at where she's pointing. I've been slumped in the bottom of the shower for, I don't know how long I sat there with the freezing cold water hammering against my skin. I thought I'd gotten it all. I thought I'd cleaned away all of the blood. The insides of my thighs are slick with it, though. Fresh, bright, red. I couldn't find any pants. I reach out, my hand grasping at thin air as I try to hold on to something.
I'm going to throw up. Shit, let's get you outside. You need fresh air.
Halliday wraps an arm around my shoulder, rushing me to the door. I barely make it down the front steps into the lawn before I drop to my hands and knees and retch into the grass. Nothing really comes up. I puked at least 3 times in the shower before I blindly staggered down the stairs, so there's barely even a mouthful of stomach acid to bring up this time. It burns like nothing else, though. The taste is foul. When I sink back onto my knees, Halliday has an arm wrapped around her own body and a hand covering her mouth. Her Pacific Ocean eyes are full of tears.
Silver, what the hell happened? She whispers.
She already knows. She suspects. If she didn't, she wouldn't be looking at me the way she is. I'm so fucking tired, I could fall asleep right here on the lawn. I need to go home, Hal. Can you find my purse? The sound of my own voice surprises me. I sound normal. I sound sober. I sound like me. I'm not me anymore, though. I'm a tragic, broken imposter occupying a tragic, broken body that belongs to someone else. 3 people, to be precise. Jacob Weaving, Samuel Hawthorne, Killian Dupree. This mangled, uncomfortable shell of muscle, flesh, and bone belongs to them. They baptized themselves in my blood, and now I'm theirs. Halliday stifles a sob.
Silver!
Her hand shakes as she reaches out, stroking a tangled strand of damp hair out of my face.
I think I should call your dad.
I whip around, eyes finally focusing properly on her.
No, I don't want him here. I don't want to talk. I just want to go home. I need my purse, Halliday.
My phone's inside that Tory Burch clutch. House keys.
If I don't find my keys, I won't be able to get inside the house without waking up Mom and Dad. Please, just go inside and find it so I can leave.
Where?
She whispers. I swallow. My throat's so raw, it feels like I'm choking down broken glass. Upstairs, top floor, the bathroom at the end of the hall.
Okay, I'll find it. I'll find Casey too. She'll know what to do.
I feel myself nodding. Time passes. I start to shiver, but I don't feel the chilly night air. I'm detached from myself, unmoored, my psyche trying to float away downstream. But no matter how hard I try to kick and swim away from the misery of my own existence, I find I'm still trapped within it. I have no idea how long I wait on my knees in the grass. Eventually, I get to my feet, wobbling like a newborn deer, and I walk to a window, peering through the glass. It's sheer luck that I immediately see Halliday, that she's even in the hallway at all. My eyes catch on her red hair. She's animated, her hands moving in the air, gesturing toward the front door. In front of her, Casey's tapping furiously into her phone. My best friend looks worried. Her eyes are sharp, spearing people through as she holds her phone to her ear. The light from the screen casts a blue glow across her face. Nervously, she tucks her hair behind her ear and my chest pinches tight, a sharp pain spreading like the roots of a tree across my ribcage. Sam. Sam's joined them, and he's listening to Halliday frantically speak. She points to the front door, undoubtedly telling the story of me wearing nothing but an oversized dress shirt with blood staining my thighs, collapsed out on the front lawn.
No, 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 God, please, no.
Sam turns, eyes narrowed as he heads toward the door, toward me. My heart almost explodes in my chest.
Run, run, Silver, go.
I am paralyzed. I couldn't fucking run if I tried. The door opens, spilling warm light out into the darkness, and I pray for the sound of Halliday's voice. She hasn't followed behind Sam, though. He's come out to me alone. The soles of his shoes crunch against the gravel pathway. He's standing right next to me. He's less than 5 or 6 inches away. It feels as though a 10-ton weight is pushing down on the back of my head, preventing me from looking up into his face. Sam's bemused laughter is quiet, but it seems loud over the thumping bass of the music still playing inside.
Huh, didn't you wash that dirty little cunt, Parisi?
I flinch, making myself smaller inside my head, shying away from his voice. His hand reaches out, his fingers tracing the line of my jaw. I freeze. I don't make a sound.
Your friends are in there rallying the troops, he says mildly.
He barely sounds interested, let alone fazed by this information.
Just curious, are you on birth control? If you wind up pregnant, that'd be really bad, don't you think? You'd have to explain that you went whoring around with not one, but 3 guys at a party. Your parents would probably be pretty disgusted, I reckon.
My mind is a void. My ears ring louder than ever. My heart thrashes, trying not to seize. Sam hooks a finger under my chin, forcing me to meet his gaze. He looks down on me like I'm the most repellent thing he's ever had the misfortune of seeing with his own 2 eyes.
I hear the morning after pill's pretty effective. Dillinger's is open 24 hours now, too. Seems like your best bet would be to make a stop there before you head home. Be silly to take any chances. What do you think, babe?
Babe, 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 babe. I can't stop the word from repeating over and over in my head. Babe, babe. Babe. I clap my hands over my ears, screwing my eyes shut, refusing to breathe. If I stop breathing, I might pass out. I might fucking die. At least if I'm dead, this madness will finally stop. Sam's hand drops to his side.
Are you listening?
I'm not. I can't. I'm not. I can't. I'm not. I can't.
Crazy fucking bitch.
He jabs a finger into my chest, sneering viciously. His false indifference vanishing in a puff of smoke.
I'd be really careful how I handled what comes next if I were you. You're gonna be faced with a choice. I'm gonna give you a piece of advice, Parisi. Right now, you're standing at a crossroads. To your left lies graduation, the end of school, summer with your friends. You finish your time at Raleigh with a smile on your face, and we all part as friends. The other direction?
He shakes his head, disappointment forming on his face.
To your right leads copious amounts of pain and suffering, humiliation, embarrassment. You won't make it to graduation if you head in that direction. Jake will make sure of it. You shouldn't have defied him like that upstairs. You really got under his skin. You fucked up his head real bad.
I'm not in my right mind. The frigid cold water from the shower must have addled my brain. If I was thinking straight, I'd make sure to stop the slightly deranged bark of laughter from exploding out of my mouth.
Sam's eyes harden like flint. He tuts under his breath, taking a step back toward the house.
All right, babe. It's your fucking funeral. Remember that.
He goes inside. I press my forehead against the glass of the window, finally dragging a shaken, terrified breath down into my burning lungs. When I look up, Sam's in front of my friends again, hands in his pockets. He's talking to Casey, his face very calm, his shoulders relaxed. Casey, on the other hand, Casey's becoming visibly more and more agitated. She turns red, her icy blue eyes filling with the kind of cold, dead fury that generally means someone, somewhere, is about to be publicly eviscerated. A minute passes. Two. Sam doesn't stop talking the entire time, words spilling out of his mouth like a goddamn oil slick, and Casey does nothing but stand there and listen. At one point, Halliday reacts to something he says, covering her mouth with both hands. Casey's posture stiffens, so much tension pouring off her that it looks like she's about to go nuclear. Halliday tries to say something to her, but she spins on her and snaps, snarling at her through her bared teeth. Sam finally stops talking. He shrugs, grins at the girls, and then pivots on the balls of his heels and walks away, rejoining the chaos of the party that's still surging all around them. Casey spears Halliday through with a look that makes my blood run cold. Still, I am a fool, though. Still, I don't see it coming. When Casey and Halliday emerge from the front door of the Wickman's house, I expect my best friend to take me in her arms and hold me. I expect her to stroke my hair and tell me everything is going to be all right. I expect her to turn that legendary rage of hers into sharp cutting words, hone them into lethal weapons, and to send them flying at the boys who hurt me. I have never been so wrong in all my life. When Casey comes to a halt before me, she doesn't meet my eyes. She tosses something at my feet, sighing tiredly. It's my purse.
What did I tell you? She spits.
What?
What did I tell you before in the bathroom with Zen? I said he wasn't for you, didn't I? I told you not to get involved with Jake. Now look at the steaming pile of shit you've landed yourself in. I'm sick of your crap, Silver. Honestly, I am.
Halliday dips her head, crying quietly. She looks from me to Casey and then back at me, as if what she's seeing take place cannot be stopped, but she can't look away. Casey finally looks up. She's always been hard, always had trouble dealing with her feelings. Anger has always been the only emotion she's ever felt safe unleashing on the world, but even her anger is absent now as she looks me up and down.
You made your bed, Silver. I'm afraid you're gonna have to lie in it. Go home. I don't even want to look at you, and neither do the other girls. The sirens can't be seen to be hanging around with trash like you.
It happens just like that. Quick, like tearing off a band-aid. Casey leaves, and she doesn't look back. She does pause in the doorway of the house, the light throwing her into shadow as she waits with one hand resting against the door jamb.
Halliday! Get inside this house now, or you'll find yourself stuck out there with her forever.
She doesn't mean stuck outside the house. She means stuck on the outside, shut out from the light and warmth of her good graces, forever shivering in the loneliness of the long shadow she casts. Halliday gives me one last, torn look before she leaves and follows Casey inside. The next hour is hell. Alone, I walk barefoot to the end of the driveway and wait for the Uber I order on my phone. The driver thinks I'm drunk and nearly doesn't let me in the car. He threatens me with extortionate cleaning bills if I throw up, but finally drives me across Raleigh to the pharmacy on the high street. Just as Sam said it would be, Dillinger's storefront is lit up, the only business besides the gas station that's still open at 3 a.m. on a Friday night. The Uber guy knows I'm not drunk now. He's actually kind of concerned for me, I think.
You want me to wait for you, kid?
I haven't even looked at him once. I've sat on the back seat, vibrating with terror because I managed to trap myself in such a small space alone with a man.
No, I'll be fine, thank you.
My legs threaten to ditch me in the gutter when I climb out of the car. It takes some convincing, but I manage to talk them into keeping me upright. The Uber driver's window buzzes down. A face appears there, but still I don't look at him.
I prefer to see you walk through your front door if it's all the same to you, he says. My name's Harry. I got a daughter your age. I'd feel like a shit father if I didn't make sure you got back safely. Looks like you've had a bit of a tough night.
A tough night. I try and think of an adequate word to describe just how tough tonight has been, but I don't think the English language harbors a word brutal enough. It is possible to walk home from town, but it would be a miserable hike with no shoes, feeling like my world has just ended. I could call for another Uber, but chances are high the next driver will also be a guy, and maybe next time that driver won't be so concerned about my well-being. Maybe he'll see me as an opportunity and take advantage. I am so, so fucking tired. Okay, I won't be a minute. The lights inside Dillinger's pharmacy are too bright. A strong medical herbal smell hits me as soon as I walk in, making my head spin. The dress shirt I stole from Mr. Wickman's laundry basket has an ink blot above the left-hand breast pocket that's shaped almost like a crescent moon. I dab at it self-consciously. Ridiculous, since I'm naked underneath the shirt and the material barely hits me mid-thigh. Not to mention my face is still stained with the remnants of my mascara, I'm covered in blood, and my feet are absolutely filthy. The woman behind the counter sees me and stops dead, a phone handset half raised to her ear.
Sweet Mary, Mother of God, she breathes. What on earth's happened to you, child?
She's in her 50s, blonde hair graying at her temples, short, a little stocky, not a lick of makeup on her face. Her eyebrows are out of control. I can't seem to stop noticing the details of her. When I get close enough, arriving at the counter, I smell her. Talcum powder and Altoids. And I almost burst into tears. I don't even know why.
Dear, is everything all right?
She puts the phone's handset back in its cradle.
You look like you've been in the wars.
My voice breaks. I have to clear my throat.
I need the morning after.
The woman's face leeches of all color. Her facial muscles relax in the weirdest way, like when an actor in a film pretends to die and everything about them just sags. She braces herself against the counter, steadying herself for a second. Then she reaches out for me and takes my hand.
Why don't you take a seat by the cough medicine over there, sweetheart? I think I should probably call the police.
No, I just want to get what I came in here for and go home.
My throat's closing up. No matter how hard I try to speak, I can't seem to get the words out. The pharmacy clerk wobbles, the edges of her distorting strangely. I think I'm going to pass out, but then I realize that I'm crying.
I want to go home.
Okay, dear Lord in heaven, help me,
the woman mutters. She lets go of me long enough to hurry down one of the narrow shelves behind her, stand on her tiptoes, and retrieve the correct box. She places it gingerly down between us, looking 10 years older than she did when I walked in here a few moments ago.
Will you open it?
I ask stiffly. The box is sealed in thick plastic, the kind they package razor blades in. You always need a pair of scissors to get through that stuff. I have no hope of ripping into it with my teeth. The woman peers at me from beneath tightly banked brows.
Don't you want to wait until you get home, sweetheart?
No.
She nods, her hands moving quickly as she produces a box cutter from the pocket of her white jacket and deftly slices through the thick plastic. She removes the box from its casing and hands it to me. I can hardly hold the damn thing still as I fumble to get it open. It takes 3 attempts to rip the cardboard tab up, and then another 2 tries to successfully tug the sealed blister pack that contains the one tiny pill free from inside.
Here, let me get you some water.
I don't wait for water. I pop the metal foil on the back of the plastic sheet, thumbing the pill free from the other side, and I throw it back as quickly as I can, swallowing hard. I walk out of the pharmacy without another word. It isn't until I'm home, sliding my key into the front door, creeping my way up to my bedroom, desperate not to wake Mom and Dad. that I realize I didn't even pay for the pill. A distant siren wails, setting me on edge as I retreat from the waking nightmare. I'm back in the cemetery, back in the freezing cold, staring down at Samuel Hawthorne's grave. It's all still so fucking fresh in my mind. It feels like it happened yesterday. Sometimes it's as though no time at all has passed, and I'm still stuck inside my own paralyzed body outside that window, looking in, unable to move or turn away as I watch my friends turn against me. "What the hell did you say to her, hmm?" I whisper at the headstone. "What the fuck did you say to Casey to make her react that way?" I've been asking myself that question for a very long time now. It must have been bad. Really fucking bad. I asked Casey once in the days after the party, and she'd spat in my face. Literally. From his cold, lonely grave, Samuel Hawthorne refuses to confess his secrets. I sigh, setting the bag down that I've been holding onto tight this entire time. Metal clanks on metal as I unzip the top of it, taking out a chisel and a hammer from inside. Dad's tools, borrowed from the garage. Most of his time spent in front of a drafting desk these days, but back when he was in college, he took a stonemasonry class. He's been promising himself that he'll get back into it at some point, but so far he hasn't had the time. I have no idea how to use the chisel and the striking tool I've taken out of the bag, but I understand the general premise. Plant the chisel, hit the chisel, leave a mark. I get to work. It's more difficult than I imagine it would be, but 20 minutes later, I achieve what I set out to accomplish. My stoneworking skills leave a lot to be desired, but the word I've chipped deep into Sam Hawthorne's headstone is perfectly legible. Devoted son, beloved friend, talented sportsman, rapist. Mallory Hawthorne's a fucking amateur. She thinks no one knows that she's the one who sneaks into the Raleigh Gardens of Rest every Tuesday night and scrawls the word murderer onto Leon Wickman's headstone. While red spray paint might look rather dramatic, it does come off with a stiff brush, soap, and a little elbow grease. I, on the other hand, have thought this through long and hard. There's no way in hell anyone's washing this away. Text message received. 1-564-987-3491. "You're not gonna make it to graduation, Silver. You're gonna wind up wishing you'd never been fucking born."
2. Alex. "I've done some pretty shady things in the past. Up until now, I've never fucking killed anyone before, though. In my hand, the gun Monty pressed into my chest as I left the Rock an hour ago feels like a ticking time bomb. It's a thing of beauty, all sleek lines and cold, unforgiving black steel, but I fucking hate the thing. I want nothing to do with it. Some people might assume my hatred of guns comes from my recent brush with death in the Raleigh High School library. At night, when I'm alone in the trailer, I sometimes find myself pressing my fingertips into the neat, violet scar I earned myself that day, flinching, my body jolting with the memory of the burning metal hitting my chest. I still feel that same breathless, creeping cold seeping through my veins when I close my eyes sometimes, too. However, that isn't the reason why I have to grind my teeth together, battling to keep my arms steady as I aim the gun at the back of Peter Westbrook's head tonight. No. I hate guns because of what happened the day I came home from school. A skinny 6-year-old with both front teeth missing, and I found my mother lying in a pool of her own blood with half her fucking head blown off. Compared to that memory, the knee-jerk recall of the moment 6 weeks ago when Casey Winters shot her ex-boyfriend and inadvertently hit me in the process is a walk in the fucking park. "Listen, man. I don't know what Monty told you, but I don't owe him shit," Westbrook grouses. He doesn't seem all that bothered by the fact that I'm pointing a gun at the back of his head. He seems a little bored. Clearly he doesn't think I'm going to shoot him, but he did drop reluctantly down to his knees when I barked out the command 10 minutes ago. "He placed an order. He got what he paid for. 5 cases. I know Monty's not too shit hot with math, but this is simple fucking kindergarten stuff, kid. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. He shrugs, sighing under his breath. Maybe the stupid bastard should stick to slinging shots and shooting porno down in that basement of his. You can tell him from me, he's not very good at... The butt of the gun makes a dull cracking sound as I bring it down on the back of Westbrook's head. I could have split his fucking skull open with such a heavy monster of a weapon, but I've opted for mild concussion instead. What's the point in opening your mouth, Pete, if all you do is lie? I don't have a clue what Monty ordered. All I know is that he's missing a black duffel bag. I don't know what's inside the bag, and I don't want to know either. I was told to come here and collect it, and I was told to make life really uncomfortable for you if you didn't hand it over. A thin stream of blood runs down the back of Westbrook's neck, leaching into the white fabric of his collared shirt. I can't stop staring at the redness of it. The man turns his head ever so slightly, his face in profile, a knowing, smug smile pulling his mouth up at the corner. And how the hell are you planning on doing that? Clearly he thinks I'm wet behind the ears, inexperienced, so green that I'll hesitate the second things begin to get violent. Over the past month, Monty's tasked me with all kinds of fucked up assignments, though. I've been recovering from a goddamn gunshot wound, aching every time I twist without thinking. But my boss at The Rock hasn't given me much of a break. Seems like I've been getting my hands dirty every other fucking day. If I have to make Westbrook hurt so I can get the fuck out of here and back to Silver, then I won't fucking hesitate. There isn't much I wouldn't do in order to get back to Silver. Casually leaning back against Westbrook's desk, I consider how best to deal with the lying sack of shit. Monty's careful with his words to the point of paranoia. He's never told me to break anyone's bones. He's never commanded me to put someone in the hospital directly, but his intentions are always very clear. If I don't come back from Bellingham with this black duffel bag, Monty expects me to wreak havoc here tonight. He'll be sorely disappointed if I leave this guy standing. I've resigned myself to the fact that I'm going to have to lay into Westbrook when he disrupts my thoughts. You're the Moretti kid, aren't you? He says. Jack's boy. The fact that he's used my father's nickname doesn't really mean much. Giacomo's hardly a common name around these parts. Most people were more comfortable referring to him as Jack. It doesn't mean he knew him. I still hesitate, though. My father fled Washington State so long ago that it is unusual to come across anyone who remembers him. Hearing him mentioned here, in this dark, seedy office, with its lacquered wood paneling and its plush cream carpet underfoot, feels just fucking wrong. Your pop never liked Monty, Westbrook says mildly. He'd probably spit teeth if he knew that limp dick bastard had laid a claim on you. Shut the fuck up, Pete. My father's irrelevant. Do you have the bag or not? Smiling, Westbrook lets his head hang loose, his chin resting against his chest. He's in his 40s, a well-dressed, well-made, solid-looking dude with hands the size of fucking shovels. I think he used to be a bare-knuckle boxer back in the day. He certainly made a lot of his money placing bets in rigged fights. I'm curious. Has Monty ever explained why he took you in, Moretti? He asks. I clench my jaw, grinding my teeth together. The bag. Tell me if you've got it or I'm gonna fucking rip your arms out of joint. He used to do runs for Monty, you know. Your old man, just like you are now. Though Jack was a little more convincing when he showed up on a guy's doorstep with a mind to threaten him. It was his eyes. So fucking dark and soulless. There was something primitive about old Jackie boy. When you looked at him, and he looked back at you, you lost all hope. You saw right away that he wasn't like other men. He operated on a level that the rest of us have evolved away from. Sex, food, money, power. Those were the only things that mattered to Jack. The bare essentials required for survival. There was no appealing to his empathy, no sense of injustice. He didn't possess either. There was only the bottom line for Jack. God help you if you ended up on his shit list. I was 5 when my father bailed. Old enough to have a few memories of the man stored away in the back of my mind, but young enough that the edges of those memories seem soft and blurry, like they might not even be real. Or perhaps I imagined them. I remember feeling glued to the floor when the sick fuck was mad at me, though. I remember panic crawling insidiously up the back of my neck every time he raised his fist to strike me, because I knew with a concrete certainty that he was going to follow through. Westbrook's barking up the wrong fucking tree if he thinks bringing up my father is going to endear him to me. If anything, he's making this situation much, much worse. "You got kids?" I ask, my voice as stiff as my posture. Westbrook laughs. "If I say yes, are you going to spare me the torture of this bullshit interrogation? Answer the question." "Yeah, I got kids. 3. 2 boys and a girl." "Nice. You beat them? Abandon them? You raise your fist to their mother?" He doesn't say anything now. The smile slips slowly from his face. "Probably best if we don't talk about my father and we concentrate on the matter at hand, huh, Pete?" The ice in my tone must chill him. He swallows thickly, adjusting his weight. "There's always bad blood between a father and his son. There's always a reason why one hates the other. Jack didn't abandon you, though, Moretti. He ran because Monty... I've officially had enough of this bullshit. I won't listen to another word that comes out of his mouth. I'm done. I'm used up and spent by men like Peter Westbrook. Men who renege on deals, who waltz around in their $1,000 suits, driving their mercs through the gates of private guarded communities where they're safe and protected from the outside world. Westbrook's the worst kind of stuck-up asshole, a bigot through and through. He wasn't born into a life of comfort and luxury. He was born in the gutter just like me. He's raised himself pretty damn high over the course of his lifetime, and I respect that. But fuck me if I'm going to let the motherfucker think he's better than me because of it. I discard the gun. The metal clunks heavily as I set the weapon aside on Westbrook's desk. The flick knife I pull from my pocket doesn't fill me with the same discomfort as the gun. I actually feel a little relieved as I turn the handles over, flipping the blade open, pivoting the knife so that the spine of the metal is pressing against the edge of my hand. Held like this, it would be so fucking easy to slit his throat, to open up his carotid and have him bleed out. All it would take is a casual, effortless swipe of the hand. My shoes, wet from the rain and caked with mud, leave dirty prints on the cream carpet as I slowly walk around the prone man in front of me. I come to a stop in front of him, a sick, tight feeling in my stomach when he looks up at me, and I see the first flickerings of real fear in his eyes. It was easy to mock me when I was standing behind him. It was easy to forget what he was dealing with, no doubt. His mind presented him with the bare facts. I am nothing more than a 17-year-old high school student employed to do Montgomery Cohen's grunt work. Towering over him now, though, Peter sees me for what I truly am. A man, broad, strong, and unrelenting, made hard by the violence I have already borne witness to in this life. I'm no wilting boy child quaking in my boots, unsure of how to proceed. Peter knows this the moment I stoop down a foot in front of him, giving him the chance to take a good, long look into my eyes. I raise my hand, flicking the knife open and closed. Peter flinches.
I told you, he stammers. Monty placed the order. I gave him the order. This black bag bullshit is... it's fucking bullshit. The bag has nothing to do with him.
He's going red in the face now. A vein pulsing in his left temple. I doubt anyone's ever burst into his office and threatened him before. He's sure as shit never had to answer to the likes of me.
Do you understand?
Westbrook spits, straining at the cuffs that are restraining his hands behind his back.
He's getting fucking greedy. He's fucking manipulating you.
I tilt my head to one side, pouting. So he's telling tales, sending me out in the middle of the night to steal random bags from you. That it?
Yes.
And he'd do that because... Westbrook growls, frustrated, rolling his eyes.
Come on, smartass. This is bad guy 101. Power means respect, and respect means fear. Fear means obedience. Obedience means more fucking power. It's an endless cycle, and Monty wants more. That bag... it means power. Whoever owns that bag becomes a very powerful man overnight. He sent you here, knowing I'll never hand it over. He knows I'll kill you before I give it up. What's that tell you, huh? He doesn't give a shit about you. You're disposable. A means to an end. Nothing more than an amusing toy he'll get bored of, the same way he gets bored of all his other toys. You think you're the only project kid Monty's taken under his wing? I hate to break this to you, princess, but you're not that fucking special. There were plenty before you, and there'll be plenty after you, too. You're gonna end up dead or in prison. Either way, you're fucking insane if you think Monty will give a shit about any of it.
Time to go, Passerotto. You have to leave. Don't be foolish, mi amore.
When she was alive, my mother was never all there. Not really. Her thoughts were so scattered, her mind drifting from one idea to the next so rapidly that it was impossible to keep up with her sometimes. Now, when she comes to me, softly whispering her words of advice and her warnings into my ear, she's much clearer, her mind free of the fog that always clouded it over. I know I did this, that I gave this to her, this clarity in death. She didn't live long enough to help me through the difficult transition from boy to man. She wasn't there to tell me what the fuck I should have done when I first met Silver. Over the years, whenever I provoked Gary into beating the living shit out of me with his belt, or before that even, when one of the other cold, bitter fuckers who took me in decided to tan my hide, she wasn't there to protect me. Sometimes she shows up like this, though, whispering quietly over my shoulder, gently nudging me towards safety. It's my own sense of self-preservation doing the whispering. It's not really her. She was buried 11 years ago, for Christ's sake. The worms finished up their work with her a long time ago, but I choose to believe her influence over me is far from dead and gone. I set my jaw, quickly lifting the blade of the knife up to Westbrook's throat. The edge of the steel is so sharp I barely even show it to his skin before a thin crimson line forms below his Adam's apple, and the shining surface of the blade is stained with blood. I don't care what his motives are. I don't care if he's lying. Monty sent me here with a purpose, and I have nothing better to do tonight than fulfill it. You know your options. I'm done fucking talking to you. If I have to stand here any longer, I'm gonna start putting this knife to good use. You know, they say the cuts don't even hurt at first, when the knife's so sharp. You could be missing more of your body parts than you'd like before you really start to feel it, and by then, I shrug. I might not be inclined to stop.
All right, Jesus Christ, kid, ease up.
I lean into the blade a little, pressing more weight behind it. A warning, a promise, a threat.
Whoa, fucking stop!
Westbrook snaps, trying to jerk away from the knife. He only succeeds in catching himself on the tip of the knife, though. The slice at his throat I just gave him was only a paper cut. If he's not fucking careful, it's going to end up cutting his own carotid.
Fine. The bag's here. It's fucking here, I swear. God damn it, will you back the fuck up? I can't give it to you if I'm fucking dead.
I withdraw the knife, plastering a grin across my face. I can see myself reflected in Westbrook's eyes, and boy, oh boy, do I look fucking insane. So fucking what, though? In situations like these, it helps if people think you might be a little unhinged. On your feet, then, I say brightly, grabbing him by the elbow and tugging him up. Show me where the bag is. Hand it over, and that'll be the last you see of me. Again, the guy laughs bitterly under his breath. He obviously doesn't believe that's true, but he's smart enough to keep his doubts to himself. His legs are shaky as he heads toward the office door, where he huffs impatiently, arching an eyebrow over his shoulder at me.
You're gonna have to open it if you want to move this thing along, he snaps.
I collect the gun I set down on his desk, returning it into the waistband of my jeans, at the small of my back, and then I open the door to Westbrook's office, holding it for him obligingly. After you, I insist. Westbrook grumbles malevolently as he storms out into the hallway, taking a right and walking off at a fast clip. I follow after him, keeping pace, carefully eyeing every door and hallway that branches off from the main corridor, making sure I'm not about to be taken unawares. It's Monday, so Gimlet's, Westbrook's club, is closed. It's after 6 in the evening, so it's unlikely we're going to run into anyone, but you never know. It never pays to let your guard down.
At the end of the hallway, Westbrook hangs a left, heading toward a large, riveted door that's been painted red. Looks like it's made out of reinforced steel. Pete juts a hip out, jerking his chin down at the left-hand pocket of his pants.
The key's in there. I'd tell you to uncuff me so I can get it out, but I'm not stupid enough to think you'd do it.
Bully for you. Congrats on not being stupid. I stick my hand into his pocket and pull out the set of keys quickly. I'd planned on hanging at the bar this afternoon. Paul invited me for a beer, but the moment I stepped foot inside the Rock, Monty had me cornered and was handing off this shitty job to me before I could say no. This was not how I'd planned on enjoying one of my only days off this week, and ending up with a handful of another man's dick and balls is only going to sour my mood further. There are 5 keys on Westbrook's fob.
Which one? I demand. The gold one, there. The old-looking one, Westbrook mumbles. It opens both locks.
There are, indeed, 2 locks on the red, reinforced steel door. I use the key he pointed out, quickly unbolting the door and then pulling it open. Inside, a bright, cold strip light casts a stark blue glow over the small room beyond. A liquor store, lined with shelves that span from floor to ceiling, laden with a supply of booze that would last me a goddamn lifetime.
In there, at the back, Westbrook clips out, on the floor by the bottles of Jim Beam.
I give him a tired, weary look. Pete, I'm going to be so disappointed if I find out this door automatically locks when it's slammed closed. His weak, irritated smile confirms that he was going to try and lock me inside the liquor store.
Can't blame a guy for trying, right?
Just fucking move. Before I decide to lock you in there and set this place on fucking fire. I hear death by smoke inhalation's a pretty miserable way to go. Westbrook stumbles a little as I shove him inside the liquor store. He reluctantly makes for a bank of whiskey bottles at the far end of the room and halts, sighing.
All right, here you go,
he says, kicking out with one of his leather shoes.
The magical, mysterious bag Monty sent you over here for. It's been nothing but fucking trouble since the moment I laid eyes on it. Untie me and get the fuck out of my sight before I call in some friends and have them play soccer with your dismembered fucking head.
Sounds like a good time. Real talk though, friends, you're fucking detestable. I can't picture you having many friends, Pete. I join him, snatching up the bag at his feet by one of its handles, determined not to bother trying to guess what's inside by its weight. A hard thing to do though. I never know what's inside any of the packages Monty sends me to drop off or collect, but this run has felt different from the get-go. There was something off about the desperate edge to Monty's voice when he told me I had to get this bag for him. The look on his face was nothing short of weird.
The key,
Westbrook snaps, spinning around to give me access to the cuffs behind his back. I'm already walking away, though.
Hey, don't you dare, you fucking punk! Westbrook yells after me. There's no cell phone reception down here. No one's coming in until 9 tomorrow morning.
I pause in the doorway, hand resting on the cool steel, pitted steel. It takes me all of 3 seconds to weigh the pros and cons of leaving Peter locked in his own liquor cellar overnight. Pro number 1, it's a fucking liquor cellar. The guy can have a great time if he sets his mind to it. 2, if he can't use his cell phone down here, then he can't call any of his goons to chase me down and ruin my night. 3, imagining the look on Westbrook's face when he realizes the handcuffs he's wearing are fucking novelty cuffs and a stick insect could pop them open makes me fucking laugh. Cons. Well, damn. Doesn't look like there are any of those. That settles it then. Westbrook's spending the night locked up in his little box. I give him a half-hearted shrug as I swing the door closed. The guy charges, trying to reach the exit before it has a chance to slam shut, but he's too fucking slow.
Hope you're not claustrophobic,
I call to him through the door. From how muffled the angry shouts are on the other side, I doubt that he'll have heard me.
Have a nice night, Mr. Westbrook.
The freezing night air tries to rip right through me as I step out of the emergency exit at the back of Gimlet's. The wind's been howling for days now, tearing through the Whitsun Valley, knocking down Raleigh's street signs, felling dead trees, causing chaos and blocking the roads in and out of town. It felt like the Camaro was going to fucking roll on the drive over to Bellingham. The weather's even worse here. Not only is the wind so much stronger as it comes raging in off the bay, but the threat of snow is hanging heavy and pregnant in the air, promising to make the drive back to Raleigh seriously sketchy. If I were smart, I'd wait the weather out, hang tight in a motel for the night, watch some bad TV, and gorge myself on vending machine food. I don't want to waste the money on the room, though, and this storm isn't a 24-hour squall. Once this cold front takes hold, it's going to snow, and it's going to snow hard. Not just for hours, but for days, and there is no way in hell I'm getting stuck in goddamn Bellingham for that long. Not with Silver Parisi expecting me to meet her in Raleigh. The very hounds of hell couldn't keep me from making that appointment. It takes a couple of minutes to jog down Culver and cross over a couple of blocks to the parking lot of the Night Stop convenience store where I left the car. By the time I hurl myself into the driver's seat and I slam the door closed behind me, my hair is stiff with ice and my eyes are streaming like crazy. Somewhere in the world, the sun's shining right now. There are beaches and coconuts and cocktails, and people are walking around in their goddamn swimsuits. But I can't for the life of me think where such a place might be because my fucking brain is too fucking frozen and I can't form a coherent thought. Fingers on my right hand ache and throb as I fumble with the car keys. An unpleasant reminder, a day 5 years ago when I'd been playing my guitar a little too loud for Gary Quincy's liking. I curse angrily under my breath, annoyed that I've even allowed myself to remember the man, which is dumb, really. I'm covered in scars, and plenty of my bones crunch and crack courtesy of all the injuries I've suffered at other people's hands. I should be used to this kind of thing by now. But there's something about this injury that makes my insides burn. Gary knew how much music meant to me. I'd wanted to play professionally. I'd wanted to pay my bills by playing the guitar. And he'd taken hold of my hand and slammed it in his door to his truck over and over again. I can still play, thank fuck. If I stretch out my hand and use the bands I was given to strengthen the muscle and the tendons, there's no real reason why I couldn't make a living through my music, one way or another. But every time I feel that fucking ache, I also see the hatred and the spite in Gary's roomy, spiteful eyes, and deep down inside, I know that it's fucking true. That motherfucker didn't end up totally destroying my hand like he'd wanted to. But he did succeed in destroying my dreams for good.
Text message received. 1-564-987-3491. You're fucking disgusting. I don't know how you can even bear to look in the fucking mirror without puking. I'm gonna cut your face up. 3. Silver. There are many different ways to love. There's the kind of love that exists between friends, the lifetime bond of camaraderie that sometimes forms in the space of a summer afternoon, playing outside on the streets, riding bikes up and down the sidewalk, and collecting bugs in jars. There's the love a person bears for their siblings or their parents, an intrinsic, deep-seated love that is always there and always remains, through slight and disagreement, spanning decades and distance and so much silence. And then there's romantic love, the kind of love poets have written sonnets about for hundreds of years. Romantic love, the linchpin of all good stories, the all-consuming, burning fire in a heart that can create or destroy in the blink of an eye, the kind of love that inspires heroic acts of sacrifice while also being the root cause of murder, jealousy, and hideous acts of revenge. Like nearly everyone else on the face of the planet, I'm well acquainted with the story of Romeo and Juliet. I've read the book, the adaptations, I've seen the movies, I've swooned over the devotion and all of the suffering held within the pages of Shakespeare's tragedy, but I've never understood it, never really felt it before. Now, though, that fire burns in my chest. I feel it from the moment I wake up to the moment I go to sleep at night. Seems to me, no one else in the world has ever been this turned around by someone before, this consumed or swallowed whole by another living, breathing, flawed human being. This love is so overwhelming, so hot and so bright, that it has to be unique in all of creation. Because how would the world keep on spinning if everyone felt this way? How would governments not collapse and wars not cease and the whole of society not come to a crumbling standstill if there were other people in this world who felt for one another what I feel for Alex Moretti? It's late. On the corner of High Street and Paulson, a figure stands in the shadows, leaning against the brick wall of Harrison's Home Hardware and Electrical Supplies, looking up at the sky. He doesn't seem to have a purpose as he gazes at the heavens, doesn't seem to be waiting for anything in particular. A passerby would probably frown at his presence, casting suspicious eyes over him and making their small-town judgments of him as he does nothing more sinister than dare to stand still and scan the midnight sky for stars. At first glance, his hair, thick with waves, is impossibly dark. Up close, it's easier to see that it isn't black, but a very dark, textured brown, the darkest of browns, shot through with the odd stand of red that unexpectedly catches the light from time to time. His eyes are dark, too. I've seen such warmth and humor in them before, but that isn't what the rest of the world sees when they look into his eyes. Strangers are generally met with a cold, predatory disregard. I suppose the sterile assessment of his gaze could sometimes be described as frightening. Vines with full-bloomed roses and studded with thorns circle his throat like a collar, the black ink peeking above the neck of his shirt, hinting at what else might lie beneath the fabric of his clothes. His jeans are ripped, his leather jacket worn, the collar popped against the biting wind and the half-hearted sleet. But there he stands, at ease, oblivious to the fact that winter has officially arrived, giving off the impression that he simply doesn't feel the cold. He's an artist's rendering of something fictional and make-believe, a charcoal smudge against a bleached-out backdrop, drawn in swift, sure, mad lines that defy the laws of physics and confuse the eye, but somehow seem all the more real because of it. I see him, and I see all of these things about him in the time it takes to inhale a lungful of sharp winter air and step off the curb on the main street, heading in his direction. When he looks over and sees me, our eyes lock, and I realize just how incredibly, totally, absolutely fucked I am. Alex Moretti isn't just the kind of guy you fall in love with in high school. He isn't just the guy who steals your heart for a summer and then fades from your affections, becoming nothing more than a rose-tinted memory in your rearview mirror. Alex Moretti is the kind of guy who sweeps into your life like a wildfire, torching anything and everything you've ever cared about before he makes himself perfectly at home, rooting himself down so deep into your soul that it becomes impossible to differentiate where you end and he begins. A slow, wicked smile spreads across his handsome face, and my heart does a triple pike backflip off a 15-meter high board. The world's such a big fucking place, and Raleigh is so damn small. The odds that I'd be born here and that Alessandro Moretti would end up moving here to work at an establishment of ill repute are so infinitely small that it all feels orchestrated. Like the universe picked out the trillions of molecules required to construct our individual bodies and arranged for them to come together at this specific time, in this specific place, for some specific purpose. Alex pushes away from the brick wall of Harrison's Home Hardware and Electrical Supplies with a leonine grace and begins to walk toward me like some sort of demigod, freshly fallen to the earth. The flare of amusement in his dark eyes promises trouble. He meets me at the curb, slowly removing his hands from his pockets and placing them on my hips. A second later, my feet are off the ground and he's lifting me up the lip of the sidewalk and planting me down next to him. "Hey there, Argento," he says, the left-hand side of his mouth tilting upward so that the faintest hint of a dimple marks his cheek. "Figured you were about 5 minutes away from standing me up." A slow smile aches at my mouth. "So, if I'd shown up in 5 minutes, you'd have given up on me and left?" He's so tall, an imposing, muscled, broad figure of a guy, towering over me, dark hair backlit from the sodium yellow glow of the streetlight over our heads. He still looks entertained, his eyes slightly narrowed as he dips down closer to me. His warm breath chases away the cold night air,
as he whispers softly into my ear. You know I wouldn't have left, Argento. I'm a lovesick dog. You told me to meet you here, so here I would have stayed, in the rain and the snow and the cold, until you eventually came to find me and put me out of my misery. My pulse quickens in the hollow of my throat, erratic and dizzying. He's playing. He wouldn't have waited here for me if I'd stood him up. No way. He would have come to find me. He would have tracked me down no matter what the weather was doing and stolen me away into the night, kicking and screaming. Except, I wouldn't have fought my abduction. He won me fair and square. I belong to him now, the same way that he belongs to me. We're connected, sealed together. So immersed in each other that some days I'm a little intimidated by how in tune we are. Cut one of us, and the other bleeds. Maybe not physically true, but emotionally. Alex stands straight, cupping my face in his palms. It's below freezing tonight. He's been waiting outside the hardware store for God knows how long, but his hands are still warm. Your hair is full of snow, he murmurs. So's yours. A fat flake lands on the tip of his eyelashes, brilliant white against the black curved strands that rim his eyes. For a second, the very sight of him standing in front of me, his strong jawline and his pronounced cheekbones and his intense, penetrating gaze boring into me, makes my ribs squeeze tight in a protective cage around my heart. He's so devastatingly handsome. He's so imperfectly perfect. He's so fucking dangerous. I've always been so careful with my feelings, even before Jacob Weaving came along and blew up my life. But now it feels as though I've been reckless. I put on a good show for myself, pretended I wasn't going to fall for the most inappropriate guy to ever walk through the doors of Raleigh High, but it was all an embarrassingly flimsy act. I knew I was going to hand myself over to him blindly, with a rash kind of abandon that now scares the living shit out of me. If he wanted to, Alex could crush me in a way that would affect me for the rest of my life. He could break my heart into a trillion pieces, grind it into dust, and scatter it on the frigid northerly wind, and there would be no way of retrieving it. I'd have to live out the rest of my days, a heartless, broken, hollow girl, with the aching memory of his lips on my mouth, and there would be nothing I could do about it. His salacious smirk fades a little as he rubs the pads of his thumbs lightly across the lines of my cheekbones. What is it? What's wrong? I am amazing at hiding my thoughts and feelings. Amazing. Which makes it all the more intimidating that Alex can just look into my eyes, reach down into my soul, and pluck out my truths. I have no way of hiding myself from him. Nervously, I smile, forcing out a shaky laugh. Oh, you know, just pondering how terrifying you are. His smile turns tight, reproving, and just a tiny little bit sad. He bumps the end of my nose with his own, playful, but there's a heaviness to his voice when he speaks. And here I was, thinking I'd found a girl who wasn't afraid of me. I'm not afraid of you, just what'll happen if... He arches an eyebrow, very still, waiting for me to continue. If you decide to move on, crush my heart under your boot heel and break me. I rush out, giving him another round of awkward laughter that sounds kind of pathetic, actually. Alex's face goes blank, but his eyes burn with a fire that makes me forget we're standing out on a snowy street in the middle of November. Break you? He whispers. I don't break the things I love, Argento. I fix them. I repair them. I treasure them. I do ridiculous, insane, very illegal things to make sure I don't lose them. I sure as hell don't break them. I also do not wear boots. I'm not an insecure person. I'm not the kind of person who worries about their boyfriend leaving them all the time. At least I hope not. I have zero experience when it comes to boyfriends. The stakes just seem so high in this particular situation that a little worry seemed prudent. Looking up at Alex, all of that worry and niggling doubt disintegrates, though. He's telling the truth. He dug up a dead man through 8 feet of frozen dirt to get his mother's necklace back, for fuck's sake. If he'd do that for a necklace, then what would he do for me? He leans down, pressing his mouth against mine, and I fall slack against him. It happens every time,
My body is so ill-equipped to deal with Alex kissing me that it always feels like I'm about to disintegrate myself. Like the molecular bonds that fuse my cells together are shaken loose by his closeness, and I'm slowly, irreversibly beginning to drift into the ether. He parts my lips, guiding them open, and I moan softly into his mouth as he slips his tongue past my teeth, probing and sweeping, insistent as he tastes me. I lean into him, my back arching, my chest crushing up against him, and Alex slides a hand down to the small of my back, pulling me even closer. His breath hitches in his throat, catching, and he lets out a pained groan. I'm so grateful that I didn't wear gloves as I reach up and wind my fingers into his hair. The thick fullness of it feels amazing as I collect myself up off the floor long enough to kiss him back. His breath quickens, dragging in and out of his nose as he sucks my bottom lip into his mouth and roughly bites down. The sharp spear of pain makes me gasp, a startled, needy pant of sound that seems to have a pretty wild effect on Alex. He slides his other hand away from my face, around to the back of my neck, and he grips me there, holding me in place against him as he forces my mouth open wider, tugging at my top lip. My head spins faster than a centrifuge as he grinds his hips forward and his erection digs into my hip, demonstrating just how rock hard the kiss is making him. Oh my fucking God. If we weren't standing on the corner of the busiest street in all of Raleigh right now. Screw it. I'm not thinking straight. I'm barely thinking at all as I slide my hand between our bodies, using the thick wool of my jacket to shield my actions, and I take hold of Alex's cock through his jeans. He stops kissing me instantly, pulls back, stares down at me, pupils blown, full lips parted, cheeks flushed against the cold. Silver. I squeeze, my fingers closing around the thickness of him, slowly moving up and down to stroke. Alex's eyes shutter closed. Holy fuck, what are you doing? What I've been thinking about doing since this morning, I whisper into his open mouth. I feel him smile against my lips. You've been turned on all day, Dulcitsa? Yes. He groans again, his fingernails digging into the back of my neck. Fuck. You have no fucking idea how badly I want you right now. I think I do. Why? Are you wet, Silver? Are you wet for me right now? I dip my head, letting my hair hide the fact that I'm blushing like crazy. But Alex takes hold of me by the chin, lifting my head until I have to meet his eyes. Oh no, no way. I'm not buying the shy act when you've got your hand on my dick. His laughter is deep, gravelly, rough with desire. The sound of his need, so blatantly fucking obvious in his voice, sends a shiver of anticipation chasing down my spine. Get your ass over here. He takes me by the hand, tugging me toward the brick wall of the hardware store where he was leaning a moment ago. My jacket is thick enough that I don't feel the sharp texture of the brick against my back when Alex leans me against the building, but the icy cold manages to seep through just fine. It doesn't matter, though. Nothing matters, because Alex is nuzzling his face into my neck, placing searing kiss after searing kiss against the sensitive skin at the base of my throat, and I can't remember how to breathe. He's close against me, chest pressing up against chest, but there's still room for him to mirror my brazen move and slide his hand between our bodies. He doesn't touch me over my jeans. His hand quickly dips below the waistband of my jeans, and then his fingers are deftly pulling my panties aside, and, oh, fuck. I tip my head back against the brick, sucking in a sharp, agonizingly cold breath as Alex's fingers find my clit. Christ, Silver. I look up at him and almost pass the fuck out when I see the wild expression on his face. You're not wet, he pants. You're fucking soaking. With small, deliberate sweeps of his fingers, Alex rolls my clit, rubbing it in a circular motion, and I have to bite back a startled cry. Shh, Alex growls softly. Hold it in, Dulcitsa, my needy girl. Don't worry. I'm gonna give you what you need. I'm gonna make you come. With a swift, gentle thrust, he pushes his index finger forward, slipping it inside me. I freeze, unable to move for a second as I register what he's just done. My body's gone into shock. A hot, burning pulse of pleasure fires between my legs, and I let out a soundless whimper. Alex grins mercilessly, a raw, fascinated glint in his eyes as he watches me react to his touch.
"That feel good, Argento?" he whispers.
"Yeah, fuck. Yes, it feels good."
He releases a pleased sigh.
"Glad to hear it. Now, what do you want? You want me to fuck you with my fingers?"
The charged words skate over my skin, inciting a very physical response from me. I tighten around Alex's fingers, and he snarls, deep and low at the back of his throat.
"Fuck me. Your body's giving me a resounding fuck yes."
He grazes his mouth over mine, pausing to flick at my lip with the very tip of his tongue.
"I'd like the words, though. I want to hear you say it. So I know."
Oh, shit. How the fuck am I going to get those words out? I've come a long way since we started dating, but it's not exactly easy for me to say things like that. Alex's mouth is filthier than a sailor's, but I'm still figuring out how to voice what I want in no-nonsense terms. Fuck, it doesn't help that I'm so turned on right now, I can barely make my mouth work.
"I want it, Alex. I want you to fuck me with your fingers. Please."
Pride shines in Alex's eyes.
"Good girl. Brave girl."
He peppers the side of my face with kisses as he slowly pumps his index finger inside me, and my mind goes utterly and completely blank.
Fuck, that feels so fucking good.
I struggle to keep myself upright as I wind my arms around his neck, bringing him down to kiss me. This is really risky. It's late and the streets are dark. There aren't many cars on the roads. I haven't seen anyone actually walking on the street since I parked the Nova, but the fact remains that Alex Moretti is fingering me in public, and I'm letting him do it. Anyone could see us. At any second, someone could walk around the corner and stumble across us, sprawled up against the wall, breathing heavily, Alex's hand working steadily between my legs. Best case scenario, embarrassment levels would be high. Worst case scenario, we'd be taken down to the sheriff's office for performing lewd acts in public. I should put a stop to this. It'd be really fucking stupid if we got caught, but I can't make him stop. Fuck, I don't want him to stop. Alex bites at my neck, teeth gouging into my skin, and I lean into the pain of it, relishing every second. His fingers work faster, expertly teasing wave after wave of pleasure from me, and I am a boneless marionette, entirely at his mercy as he puppets me, bringing me closer and closer to the edge.
Oh, fuck, fuck, Alex, please.
I don't even know what I'm asking him so desperately for. For him to stop? For him to put me out of my misery and send me